Skinner, founding partner of the public relations agency Nexus, former special advisor to a cabinet minister in the Rishi Sunak government, and Scarlett Maguire, director of the polling company JL Partners. They are here to take your calls. So many things to ask them about today. Tory leadership, Israel, and a lot of other things. 0345 6060 973. You can WhatsApp on that number and do watch us on Global Player.
On your radio, on Global Player, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 8 o'clock. Israel's defense minister says the next stage of the war against Hezbollah will begin soon, while the Iranian-backed group says it's expecting an imminent ground invasion. Joe Biden has renewed calls for a ceasefire and also confirmed he's sending a few thousand additional troops to the Middle East. The Conservatives' former Middle East and North Africa minister, Tobias Elwood, has been talking to Ian Dale on LBC.
There'll be huge consequences if Iran gets involved, which I think they now will do, and as well as the Houthis in Yemen. We'll see the Red Sea likely close down again, and the Straits of Hormuz, where a third of the world's oil comes out as well.
Teachers at the UK's biggest education union have accepted a new pay offer. Members of the NEU will now receive a 5.5% pay rise. The UK's most senior civil servant has announced he's standing down at the end of the year on health grounds. The Cabinet Secretary Simon Case has told colleagues he has a neurological condition. And the French far-right leader Marine Le Pen has gone on trial alongside other officials from her party, accused of embezzling funds from the European Parliament. She denies violating any rules. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed down 50 points at 82.70. The pound will buy $1.33 and €1.19. LBC weather staying wet and windy in the east of England overnight, drier with clear spells elsewhere, and a low of 3 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation, Cross Question, with Ian Dale.
Hello, a very good evening. It's 2 minutes past eight here on LBC. Welcome to Monday's Cross Question. Our panel tonight, Anne-Marie Trevelyan is former Conservative MP and Cabinet Minister, served in the Foreign Office, so she will have some interesting things to say, should anyone want to phone in about Israel. I mean, who knows? Nobody may. Tom Skinner, founding partner of the public relations agency Nexus. He was former special advisor to Michelle Donlan during her time as both culture and then science secretary, and basically used to organise Conservative conferences. That's so much better run in your day, Tom. And Scarlett Maguire, director of the polling company JL Partners. The number to call, as ever, 0345 6060 973. You can text on 84850, say Alexa, send a comment to LBC, and you can watch us on Global Player.
Call 0345 6060 973. Tweet at LBC. Text 84850. Cross Question with Ian Dale. This is LBC.
Let's go to our first caller. It's Steve in Manchester. Steve, hi, go ahead.
Good evening, Ian. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I am in England's second city, aren't I? Or is Manchester claiming that nowadays?
Oh, you know, it goes backwards and forwards like a tennis match, doesn't it?
What's your question, Steve?
Ian, bearing in mind that it's abundantly clear that neither Israel, Hezbollah or Hamas care a jot what Western media or Western politicians think, what is the role of the West in this conflict?
Anne-Marie.
Well, that's such a big and really important question. I think the challenge we have is, as democratic nations, the UK, the US, Europe and many others, who have a very strong belief in standing up for our values, those values of freedom, of sovereignty, the right for a state to have a safe country for their citizens to live in, Israel is presently under very serious attack from every direction, and they're fighting back to defend themselves. And we as Western nations, as you say, are, you know, we're powerless, if you like, to fix it. What we can do is highlight and share our support, our voice of support, and call for those who are those terrorist groups to desist, also to use the tools that we have around sanctions policy, for instance, to restrict the capacity of those terrorist groups, those aggressors, to attack in a number of different ways, and to try and protect through the humanitarian routes what we can. It's a really, really tough call. But I think at its heart is, you know, we will stand alongside Israel as they defend their right to exist.
But what does it say when Israel, frankly, ignores Western countries? I mean, if there's any remote criticism of Israel, it just shakes it off and it doesn't seem to matter. Doesn't that indicate a weakness of the West in general?
So a lot of conversations that go on obviously are not public or discussed. You know, the networks of diplomacy, of, you know, military ties, all those are very deep and very strong. And Israel is a very important ally to us in support of a lot of what we do as well in protecting our citizens. And they're a country that we are therefore very, very closely aligned to in that sense. But I think, turn it on its head, if, God forbid, you know, 1,000 young people were kidnapped out of Birmingham today, taken hostage, many, many slaughtered in the most appalling fashion, would we not expect our government to do all in its power to get them back and you know, eliminate the terrorists who had done that to us? I think if we look at it from ourselves, we start to understand perhaps more viscerally what it is that they need to do for their citizens.
But if you go by some of our callers on this subject, over, not just today, but over the years, I mean, we had one this evening, Melissa, who just doesn't think that you should respond in any way to any attack. And I said, well, you're a pacifist. And she sort of denied that she was. But there's a sort of weakness in the moral fibre of the West nowadays, isn't there?
So should we, and that's a really interesting challenge, should we not do anything at all and just leave Israel to fight its battle alone? We could do. Let's look at Ukraine, invaded by a bully neighbour, you know, appalling attacks on its citizens, on its healthcare, on its energy systems, on civilians. There are basic international kind of, you know, rule of law, an order that says in order to try and live peacefully together on this planet, these are the frameworks around which we will all try and live. And when someone breaches that, a bully like Putin or a terrorist group like Hamas or Hezbollah, then if we don't stand together in full voice and using the tools that we have to support the country defending itself, we are saying we don't care. Invade us if you want to. Do you know what France wants to have the UK? Help yourself. We're not going to stand by. We're not going to stop you. We'll just all learn to speak French. I mean, that's just, that doesn't make any sense, I think, to most people. And it certainly doesn't make sense to me.
Scarlett McGuire.
I think it's the Israel conflict is sort of, I mean, it's not unique, but it is unusual, especially at the moment, given how much resonance it has in a lot of the Western countries that will be working out and deciding what they should do at the moment. Certainly true in US and the UK, that the leaders there in both of the countries here and there feel under a huge amount, I think, of domestic pressure, which is altering or potentially altering what they might do. I think that will be particularly true of Keir Starmer, given the impact it had, even in just the most recent election. I think more of an impact than many Labour MPs had bargained for. And I think this will be, obviously, no one wants to see anything like this happening, but I should think this will mean it's especially unwelcome for him at the moment, already facing a tricky time domestically.
Is there any polling on our general attitudes to self-defence? I mean, I'm not quite sure what question would be asked, but I wonder if public opinions or public attitudes have changed over the years. Like, for example, I mean, during the Falklands War, there was a massive support for what the Thatcher government did to take back the Falklands. But I wonder, sort of since then, whether our opinions have changed in any way?
It's a great question. It's that yes minister sketch, and that it partly depends on how you ask the question.
you should know.
Exactly. What I think you do find over and over again is that if you ask any question that has the word ceasefire in or pause in fighting, that is what the public will want to go for. Most people would much rather see peace as opposed to conflict. Obviously, the tricky thing is that things tend to be a lot less black and white than that, and a lot more nuanced, and often involve sadly potentially some conflict in order to get to those ends. And I think that's where it can be quite difficult to negotiate with the public. I think, again, it's actually been quite an unusual conflict in that Russia-Ukraine, it was actually getting close to black and white with the English public, less so with some of the other Western countries, but England in particular, in that the British people, especially at the start of the invasion, were firmly, firmly behind Ukraine's side and really supported the leadership role that England took in supporting Ukraine against the Russian invasion. The same is not true of the conflict in the Middle East when it comes to Israel. I think Israel has struggled with its sort of PR, its reputation in countries abroad, certainly the case in the UK, and actually it's got much worse for them since October the 7th. So we saw that when October the 7th happened, public opinion was split basically three ways equally between sympathies more with Israel, sympathies more with Gaza, and don't know / don't care. And it's moved now firmly towards sympathy with Palestinians and sympathy with those in Gaza. And I think, again, that's just going to complicate how people are evaluating how to respond to this now.
Thomas Skinner.
It's a really interesting question about Western influence over the conflict.
Can we just explain? You're not that Tom Skinner.
Not the apprentice Tom Skinner. No, he's far more famous than me.
Because he's on this programme sometimes as well.
He's fabulous, yeah, but I'm not that Tom Skinner. I disappoint people week after week by not being
Bish bash Tom Skinner.
I'm
Yes, you do.
Exactly.
He's a really interesting question about Western influence. Taking the West as a whole, because America traditionally has had huge influence over the region. And given the position they are in their politics, with Biden coming to the end of his presidency, it's hard to see that they can impact the region as much as they traditionally have done. And in the UK, I also have concern that with the new government's approach to slightly tokenistic arms sales, where they've shown a bit of a leg to the anti-Israel lobby, that without having any impact whatsoever, we've just lost a little bit of influence over the Israelis, because we've achieved virtually nothing, but have actually upset an ally in the region, a key ally in the region. So I think actually the question's really interesting, and we may find that our influence is less powerful than it has been because of our actions recently.
But does it matter that not only Israel, it seems, but both these terror groups, Hamas and Hezbollah, as Steve says, seem not to really care what anybody thinks in the West about what they're all doing?
Clearly it matters, because the conflict there is obviously appalling. And if neither side is going to listen to reason, then there's a real challenge for the whole world. And we've got instability in the Middle East, as Anne-Marie said, instability in Ukraine. And it's a very challenging time globally. So the new foreign secretary has a real challenge on his hands, because we've got all these burning fires around us, and it's a really difficult balance.
Right, Steve, thank you very much for that. Let's move on to Martin in Doncaster. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Ian, panel. Yeah, and the question is would Liz Truss have done a better job than Rishi Sunak at the general election if she had still been leader?
Well, she claimed at a fringe meeting today during a speech that she would have indeed done a better job. She didn't quantify that, whether the Labour majority would have been 179 instead of 180. But Anne-Marie.
So the what-ifs in politics are always a challenging question. The reality is that when Liz was briefly in office, indeed she was, you know, less far down in the polls than Rishi became, but there was also a huge Labour lead, which we didn't see at the general election. Labour won this election by default because a lot of people were cross with us, and they voted Reform on the one side to make their point. They voted Lib Dem on the other, as they have done historically, or indeed a lot of them stayed at home. So Labour's victory is a very thin one in that sense. But would Liz or Rishi have had a different outcome? I think the reality is that the voters wanted to make their point in one form or another to get us out.
You were a very strong backer of Liz Truss, weren't you?
So I supported Liz, I think. I mean, in terms
a bit
of
an attack dog, I seem to remember for her.
Well, I think all of us, when we are in a cabinet, we support our team.
You single-handedly destroyed Penny Mordaunt, I think.
I don't think that's entirely fair. Penny is alive and well and doing fine, and
we
work together.
Her tomorrow.
Good. Well, we work on all sorts of things together, and it continue to have a huge passion for supporting our armed forces, and speaking out on the investment that we need to see in defence so that we can protect our economic security. So I think that's the reality. Liz's economic policy is one that, in its broadest sense, that conversation around growth was one that I think many, many Conservatives agree with. I mean, it sort of makes me laugh. Rachel Reeves is saying the same words as Liz was. I look forward to seeing if she delivers anything like the sort of what were then considered radical prospects by Liz, things like, you know, infrastructure, planning deregulation and so on, to be able to shift the dial. I think we would, I think many Tories would cheer on Rachel if she can achieve that in the way that Liz wasn't able to do. But, you know, Liz found that, you know, the pressures of the job and how she was managing it incompatible with delivery.
That's one way of putting it. Thomas Skinner, you worked for Boris Johnson, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. How do you answer that question?
And Theresa May and David Cameron before that. So I've got... Okay.
Yeah. Even longer than me.
No need to boast.
There were, over the last few years, there were two occasions when our popularity really tanked. The first one was around the Partygate stuff, and the second one was the budget 2 years ago. So, in sort of grand terms, that's where huge amounts of our support was lost, and Rishi was unable to get any of it back. Whether if Rishi had won that election, things may have been different. They may not have been. If Liz had stayed, again, they may have been different. She may not have called a slightly earlier election, which was Rishi's clearly big mistake in office. So as Anne-Marie says, it's impossible to say, but I think probably the public had decided after 14 years of parliamentary party infighting, division, all sorts of elections, referendums, you name it. I think they decided that probably 14 years was enough for us, and it's time for us to go away, lick our wounds, have a think, and then come back stronger.
Or as Gavin Williamson might have put it, to shut up and go away. Scarlett McGuire.
I think I can, actually. I do think that Liz is wrong on that front. I think you can even just look at how they both fared at the election as MPs. Liz Truss lost her seat with the largest swing against her in the country. And I actually think you would have seen something similarly motivated. I mean, the public were already pretty motivated, as Tom was saying, to get the Conservatives out and to make sure that they were given a proper kicking. But I think what happened in Liz Truss's seat sort of underlines the fact that I think things would have actually definitely been worse, or almost definitely been worse, had she still been Prime Minister.
Just finally on this, Anne-Marie, do you ever have an inclination to sit Liz Truss down and say, do you realise how you're making yourself look? I mean, today she was talking about, well, if the far-right Argentinian president, Villela, I think his name is, was running for leader of the Conservative Party, she'd support him. And you think, well, how does that look?
So, I think all those who have served, obviously we believe in, of all the parties we believe in, you know, freedom to speak your mind. She is therefore free to do so as a former, as you say, a former MP now, as well as a former Prime Minister. And if it doesn't chime with what the Conservative Party wants to be bringing together going forwards under whichever one of our four candidates wins in the next month, that's okay. We will bring together what is a centrist set of policies, and we will hold Labour to account under the new leader. Liz, Theresa, Boris, David Cameron, John Major, they're all free to share their views if they wish to do so, and the party that is elected and going forwards will be the one that puts the structure and the manifesto together.
Well, I'm looking forward to the next question and to your answer to it, Anne-Marie, because I think, given, how should we put this, given your appearance in the studio today, I think you are very well qualified to answer the next question. That's a tease, ladies and gentlemen. It's 17 minutes past 8.
This is LBC.
EasyJet's Big Orange Sale is now on, with up to £100 off city breaks. Book now with just a £60 per person deposit. Search EasyJet Holidays. Select the dates up to the 31st of the 3rd, 25. Book by 11 p.m. the 1st of the 10th, 24. Deposit available up to 28 days before departure. Minimum spend required. T's and C's apply. At all protected.
When did the Falklands War end? What about the war in Afghanistan? What a second war in Iraq? For many, the battle continues. Years after the fighting stopped, there are thousands of veterans who still suffer isolation, fear, nightmares as a result of what they've experienced. Combat Stress provides intensive mental health treatment to UK veterans with complex mental health problems. Combat Stress, for veterans' mental health. To find out more, go to combatstress.org.uk.
As a nation, we're a generous lot. You could say giving is in our blood. And right now, we need all of you Giving Taps to give blood and help provide life-saving treatments. Blood is amazing. It can help combat cancer, ease emergencies, help fight sickle cell, and create life-saving medicines. So, please book an appointment and give blood now. We have lots of appointments available at convenient times, and our donor centers are based in the heart of cities. It takes an hour to save up to 3 lives. If you're the Giving Type, please book an appointment at blood.co.uk today.
Cross Question with Ian Dale. Watch live on Global Player. This is LBC.
It's Cross Question at 19 minutes past 8. We have Tom Skinner with us, founding partner of the public relations agency Nexus, former Conservative advisor. Scarlett Maguire is director of the polling company JL Partners, and Anne-Marie Trevelyan, former Conservative MP and cabinet minister. Steph in Dorset texts to ask, please ask the panel what the Conservative Party needs to do to connect with younger voters. Well, I'm tempted to say that the other two might as well not take part in this, because Anne-Marie Trevelyan has come up with the answer, haven't you, Anne-Marie? You have decided to have a tattoo on your neck.
I have. I've secretly obviously been longing to take up this challenge. I've never had a tattoo. I'm far too scared to the idea of needles to have a tattoo. But Tom Tugendhat's team, just for full disclosure, I'm chairing Tom's campaign, so I am obviously a supporter. But the team decided that at conference it would be great fun to have lots of lively, fun merchandise using different ways to use the word Tugendhat. So Tugendhat, Tugendtan, Tugendtat, and so on. So there's all sorts
there's a lot of
tat. Well, it's a merch at conference. Of course there is. So this is nothing, the very particular Tugendhat which I have adorned my neck with.
Nothing quite to rival the Robert Jenrick baseball cap, which has the slogan "Bobby J for me" on it, which I understand from the Urban Dictionary means something else.
So I'm obviously far too old to understand that.
I'll tell you in the break.
Okay, you tell
anyway,
me anyway,
seriously, it's a serious question. The Conservative Party is traditionally not connected with younger voters, apart from when I was young. When
and me.
Margaret
you
Thatcher
and me both?
Really... I mean, she got me into politics at the age of 18, and there hasn't really been... David Cameron, I suppose, to a certain extent too. But in 2024, what can you do to appeal to younger people?
So it's a really important question, and how have we failed to do that when a lot of the policies we've been espousing and indeed driving through in the last few years of government are really important to young people? So all the work we've done around net zero and the environment, and really trying to lead the world on finding solutions for this, you know, global crisis, building new homes, not enough of them, and I think that's one area where demonstration of, you know, making that go more quickly is really important, and that sits around to our earlier point about planning deregulation and making it easier to build homes where they're needed. But I think also the lack of trust is not a generational issue particularly. I think that loss of trust that we've found ourselves in with the electorate as a whole means we really need to sit down and restate what it is to be a Conservative and why it is that we're worth supporting. I think what's really interesting, I look at my kids who are in their 20s, and I think they voted for me at the election, but I mean, obviously it's a secret ballot, so you never know, do you? But they're really, you know, sensible, hardworking young people. They've got very different jobs. But as they start to work, they're like, blimey, have I got to pay all this tax? Hang on. It's really interesting to watch as they become, you know, active young adults, how new things bother them, and they are starting to listen to what, you know, the politicians and the government systems mean to them. And I think we've got to reconnect not only the single issue passions that young people have, but also why it is that what the decisions that government makes means to them. It's really important in every part of their life.
Well, let's go to the two younger members of our panel. Well,
That's not an insult. I know I gave my age away by saying I was...
You're younger than me, so...
only just. So, I've got a tattoo, though. Have you?
No, I have not, and never will have. Scarlett.
I think the Conservatives are facing an existential question.
Call Prince Albert, though. Scarlett.
You know, I think the Conservatives are facing an existential question when it comes to this sort of ticking demographic time frame. It's not actually just younger voters, it's working age voters. I think the crossover age where someone started voting Conservative at this election was 63, which is staggering, and is not going to see the party in very good stead. And it's a problem that you see and it gets worse as you get further down. And actually, you know, I think 12% of 18 to 24-year-olds say they think the Conservatives representatives look after their interests. So that's a very staggeringly small amount of people. But if anything, actually, it's slightly shocking it's even that high. That's more than voted for them at the last election. In fact, if anything, any younger people with sort of right-wing inclinations seem to be starting to look more towards reform. Now, that's also happening on the left. I think we're seeing a trend in general where I think the whole electorate's actually starting to look away from mainstream parties and towards smaller parties and populist parties. But it seems to be particularly pronounced with young people who I think often don't feel listened to or like politicians even trying to make an offer for them. So I do think it's something that the party should think about a huge amount. I think there can be a slight misunderstanding with young people as well, because actually quite a lot of the time their priorities might not look that different. I think the environment's a really, really good example. They don't necessarily care a lot more about the environment than other generations do. They do care more about housing, I think, as Anne-Marie rightly brought up. So I think that's definitely a good place to start. But there needs to be a real effort to bring them in and to bring them in the conversation. Otherwise, I think not only are the Conservatives looking at this demographic time bomb, as I said, but I think the whole country then starts to face a democratic deficit as different people opt out, and turnout, I think, is increasingly bad amongst young people. And even just to use my friend as an example, you know, I'm 31, so I'm not that young, but I'm 31. And actually, more friends of mine did not vote than voted at this election. And I don't think we're a particularly lousy bunch. In fact, if anything, we're probably on the more affluent and educated end of things. But there was such widespread disillusionment and lack of faith. And I think that's replicated across the board. And it's going to take quite a lot, I think, for Labour, actually, to get a handle on that too. But bigger question for the Conservatives.
And Tom, what attracted you to the Conservative Party? And how old were you?
I got into the Conservative Party through necessity. I went on a charity cycle ride when I moved to Gloucester in 2010. Thought it was going to be loads of us. It was just me and the local MP cycling from Gloucester to Westminster. By the end of it, I had a job. And the rest is history. But Scarlett's absolutely right. The switchover age when people are more likely to vote Labour to Conservative, 63 at this election, that's an absolute disgrace. Mm. But more worryingly, it went up, I think, from 53 in 2019.
It was lower, I think.
And if that trajectory continues, in a couple of elections' time, the average Conservative voter is going to be dead. Mm. So there is a real, real problem. And I think there's lots of things that need to change, as Scarlett said. Firstly, on our general tone, I mean, if we paint a picture that our best days are behind us and everything's gloomy, it's hardly a surprise that young people want to sort of follow us into this dismal future that we're painting. So we actually need to be optimistic in our outlook. Our communication from the last election was poor digitally, very poor. We got out digitally.
That's generous of you, if I may say so.
I was a little bit part of it, so I don't want to sort of myself off.
There wasn't much money. I mean, there was a limitation as well.
No, it wasn't much money. But we were out digitally out-campaigned by a party that didn't exist 2 or 3 years earlier, and they absolutely slammed us online. A huge problem. And then there's policy things as well, housing, climate, and the tax regime, as Anne-Marie said. I think there's ways you could benefit the tax system and skew it towards younger people much more effectively than it currently does.
Mm. But don't you think that the performance of reform rather goes against what you've just said? Because if you look at the reform policy platform, I hope I'm not doing them disservice here, it's we're against the other. There's very little that you can identify that they're for. And yet, I mean, if you want to win an election, if you think back to Tony Blair, for example, he presented a really positive vision of what he wanted to do and won a landslide majority. Now, Keir Starmer was a bit doomy and gloomy and didn't have much sort of sunlit uplands rhetoric. But he didn't need to, in a way, because the Conservative Party seemed so out of it and so tired. But what can the party do, or what can the new leader do, whoever it is, to inject that sort of positivity which just has been absent for so long?
I think the last election is an interesting example, because people, I don't think, were voting en masse, although some obviously were. They weren't voting en masse for reform. They were voting against the Conservatives, or they weren't coming out for the Conservatives. Mm. They weren't voting, in most cases, for the Liberal Democrats. They were voting against the Conservatives. So it was a very negative election. And the new leader just needs to be optimistic and have a vision for the future which people can get behind. Tony Blair, you say, probably the best example in our lifetime in modern history, but David Cameron, when he came in 2010 and the big society stuff, was actually optimistic and forward-looking. Mm. And we've definitely lost that probably since the referendum, and we've had it. We've found it really, really difficult to be optimistic.
This is interesting. James says, I'm 37 and a committed Conservative. We need to stop bringing in young, inexperienced leaders in favour of experienced, even seasoned leaders to run the party. Anne-Marie? And there's maybe something in that.
So I think certainly
this is James Cleverly's pitch. Well, I've got the experience.
So you need to have some idea how government works, without a doubt. That's important if you're going to lead, because you know, it's a complex machine, and certainly sitting from the opposition benches as we are now, the new leader is going to need to hold Keir Starmer and all his secretaries of state to account on everything. You know, we've been running the place for 14 years. There have been an enormous number of bumps in the road, some self-inflicted, but most not. Just big, big events that have created huge, you know, waves in normal and everyday life. But the new leader has got to have, I think exactly you're right, Tom, optimism and rebuild trust in the Conservatives. Now, that's not about, I mean, you could take someone who's been in Parliament for 50 years. You've either got that skill or you haven't. You either are a natural leader who is optimistic, has great confidence in the values that are the core of the Conservative Party, why they're important, why they remain important. You know, they've been at the core of what we do for 200 years, and they are, you know, the ones that help us to build belief in freedom, in, you know, prosperity, the purpose of, you know, encouraging and giving people the tools to do the best they can. All of those things are absolutely core Tory values, and you need a leader who's just going to espouse and put them into practice in whatever fits the next 10 and 15 years of the Conservative Party's journey and our country's journey. We're going to have 4 years of Labour, in my view, costing us all a fortune, possibly without the sort of upside on investment and growth that, you know, the narrative says. But I fear their choices aren't going to deliver that, because the private investor doesn't wish to be clobbered over the head. So we're going to have a lot to pick up, as ever, as always it happens, because every party tends to come in after a Labour government and have to, you know, pick up the pieces and crack on. So our leader now is going to have to be an amazing optimist, as well as someone who can hold Labour to account.
And who might that be, Emory?
Well, I'm a fan of Tom Tugendhat, yeah, as it happens.
I do apologise to the other two candidates. We haven't got anyone to speak up for
But
them.
Do you know what? They're all fabulous. I mean, they're all great friends. I've worked with all of them in different ways, different bits of cabinet activity through the COVID crisis. And, you know, they're all fantastic people. I love them all dearly. I genuinely think Tom has the strongest leadership capacity, the ability to bring the party together, to shake down and deal with the problems and point us in the right direction. He is someone that, I think someone said this to me today, somebody would follow if only out of curiosity. And that's leadership.
Do you know, the best line that I've heard delivered from any candidate so far was yesterday, when Kemi Badenoch was talking to Trevor Phillips, and he was saying, well, aren't you a bit rude and sort of direct? And she said, if someone comes swinging for me, I'll swing back at them. And I thought, that's the spirit.
No, you don't mess with Kemi. It's great. She's very straightforward.
Right, we will come to more of your questions in a moment with our panel. It's 8:32 on LBC. Let's get the news headlines from Tim Daly.
A US official is saying the current positioning of Israeli troops suggests an IDF ground offensive in Lebanon could be imminent. The UK's foreign secretary has reiterated calls for Britons in the area to leave. Unite is calling thousands of job losses at one of the biggest steelworks in the world industrial vandalism. After more than 100 years, the last furnace at Tata Steel in Port Talbot is closing today. And Liz Truss has told the Conservative Party conference the Tories would have fared better at the general election if she'd remained in charge. She's Britain's shortest-serving prime minister, lasting 49 days in office. LBC weather staying wet and windy in the east of England overnight, drier with clear spells elsewhere, a low of 3 degrees.
This is LBC.
A fully grown elephant weighs as much as your...
Mom! You promised I could watch my show!
But you've got terrible taste! Buy a Samsung Galaxy Z Flip 6, Z Fold 6 or S24 series from a participating retailer and you can claim a Chromebook Go worth £299. Keep the content rolling with more screens for everyone. Purchase by the 3rd of October. Claim from Samsung within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
Nobody asks to have a lifetime of memories slowly erased. Nobody asks to have a loved one not recognize them. Nobody asks to feel lonely or confused. But today, you could change this. By leaving a gift in your will to Alzheimer's Society, you'll help fund life-changing support, vital campaigning, and groundbreaking research to tackle Britain's biggest killer. Discover the impact your gift can make. Search Alzheimer's Society Wills.
Did you know you could get the winter fuel payment or the equivalent in Scotland if you get pension credit? Pension credit is worth, on average, £3,900 per year and gives you help with other living costs. It's for people aged 66 or over and on a low income. Check the online eligibility calculator today to see if you're entitled. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. Eligibility criteria apply.
Love my Toyota Corolla. I do. Love it.
The Corolla's nice and comfy. My kids love it.
It's low maintenance. Looks great. Worth every penny.
My Corolla is great. Yeah. Plenty of room for my kit. Toyota Corolla me nu bought by Sunday. Ehi meri pehli car si. Ehi me horn chalondiya.
For 50 million drivers everywhere, there's one clear choice. Search Toyota Corolla to see why it's the world's favourite car. To verify, visit toyota.co.uk/Corolla data.
Cross Question with Ian Dale on LBC.
Anne-Marie Trevelyan is here, former Conservative MP and Cabinet Minister. Tom Skinner, former SPAD, now founder of the, or founding partner of the public relations agency Nexus. That was the name of my university TV station. Just thought I'd throw that one in there.
Fantastic.
And Scarlett Maguire, director of the polling company JL Partners. Right, our next question is another text question from Jeremy in Worcestershire. How closely should the Conservative Party associate with Nigel Farage and Reform UK? Kemi Badenoch has said that she'd be happy to work with Reform in Parliament, but has ruled out any formal electoral pact, saying that the Reform MPs are not real Conservatives or serious people. Meanwhile, James Cleverly says Rishi Sunak's stop the boat slogan was an error. Well, I'd like to know whether you, the three of you, agree with that, but also how closely should the Conservative Party associate with Nigel Farage? Scarlett, what do you, presumably there's quite a bit of polling on this sort of thing, and given there are lots of people, I think, in the Conservative Party who think, well, Nigel Farage is really one of us and therefore we should do something with him. But then again, there are lots of people who vote, former Conservatives, who voted Liberal Democrat, who would be horrified by that.
Yeah, I do think that it's probably wiser to stay away from that. I do think Reform pose a really, really difficult question for the Conservative Party. And I think there's been, we're now not as used to as many opinion polls as we were getting during the campaign. But of the voting intention polls that have been released, firstly, one striking thing is we've now had two in a row where everyone's been under 30%, which I think is where we're heading, generally speaking, and could mean some quite unusual outcomes under our first-past-the-post system. But that, to being one side, it's Reform that are really benefiting. And actually, it's been interesting, this conference, because I think I've encountered quite a lot of buoyant Conservatives who are thinking, you know,
isn't
things
that
are going
weird?
It is weird.
It's been more cheerful here than last week in Liverpool.
Exactly, that's exactly what I thought. And I think it's very odd because people are walking around, and yes, Labour is doing, I think, surprisingly badly. It is for a new government that's come into power. In fact, it's sort of underperforming what is usual. But also, the Conservatives are underperforming for a new opposition that's come in as well. And they've actually remained pretty much static on where they were. So if you ask the electorate now, 7 in 10 still say they have an unfavourable view of the party. Just 22% say they have a favourable view. That's about the same that voted for the election. They're not moving forward. The people that are actually showing movement in the right direction in most of these polls are Reform. And I do think actually it's going to be parties like Reform and also the Green Party that capitalise first off from badly Labour is doing. But I appreciate that's not what you asked. In terms of the question about whether to go to Nigel Farage, I think it could be too divisive with their electorate. I do think, though, that actually there is, I think, quite a lot of the questions posed this conference has been, you know, should they go after Reform voters or Liberal Democrat voters? And I think that's a slightly different question. And actually, I guess we did some research, which might be potentially good news for the Conservatives on that front, which is if you park Nigel Farage to one side, these voters, the ones who defected from the Conservatives to Reform and then likewise to Lib Dem, have more in common than you would think and share a very similar set of priorities and don't necessarily look like people who voted Liberal Democrat in 2017 and 2019, and in fact still prioritise immigration, for example, above everything else. So that, again, I think leads on to your next point. I think the stop the boats thing, I think actually Rishi Sunak identified those five priorities incredibly well, and I think stop the boats, it is incredibly important that whoever comes in with a plan to deal with immigration, because we know that 7 in 10 voters do want to see it reduced. That's sharply up on where it was 2 years ago, and it is a real, real concern. I guess the problem is saying you're going to stop the boats and sort of knowing that you're not going to be able to is never going to lead to a very good situation. I think that's what part of why they're picking up so many of the pieces now.
Tom?
I think insulting them is definitely not the answer. Mm. So I obviously can account for her own views and what she said, but insulting them or their politicians, by extension, you're insulting their voters, which, generally speaking, is not a very good start. If we chase reform votes, we're likely to lose other votes in other parts of the electoral coalition. So what you gain on one hand, you'll lose maybe many more on the other. And also, you can't out-Farage Farage. Nigel Farage is a very, very talented communicator, very, very talented politician. Now, Boris isn't in Parliament. He's probably the standout in Westminster. So getting into a row with him is not very sensible. I think while we're here in Birmingham at conference and sort of going through this slightly navel-gazing, but licking our wounds and picking our next leader, I think we need to have less focus on other political parties and really focus our attention on delivering things for voters. Because if we're focused on voters and not political infighting, people will actually start to notice, and then they'll start coming back to the Conservative Party. The whole time we say, what do we do about reform? We don't actually have to do anything about reform. We actually have to deliver for voters, and then reform don't become a problem because people will see the Conservative Party as the natural party of government and the party that can improve people's lives.
Just to clarify something you said about Kemi Badenoch's comments about insulting reform voters, she actually said, I don't believe reform are real conservatives. They, like the Liberal Democrats, are not serious people. And by that, I mean the reform politicians. The reform voters are our voters. But actually, the reform manifesto did not add up.
I disagree with a few bits of this. The first one being, there's no such thing as our voters. There are voters who sometimes will vote for us, and this year, many, many millions of them didn't vote for us. And this notion that there's one type of Conservative I find really troubling as well, because I've been in the Conservative Party for 15, 16 years. Ian, you've been in the Conservative Party for
longer.
A couple more than that. Anne-Marie, similarly, probably a couple of years longer. But we all have different views on different things, but we're all Conservatives under the same family. I'm a
46 years.
46 years.
Wow, good effort. You get a medal at 50, you know that.
Get a letter from the king soon. So we're all different. So the four people standing for leader, Tom Tugend, Hart, James Cleverly, Kemi and Rob, all very, very different. But I wouldn't say that none of them were Conservative. I wouldn't ever say Rob's not a Conservative or James isn't a Conservative or Tom's not a Conservative. Because it's so broad. And this notion that there can only be one type of Conservative, I think, is flawed. And if we're looking so narrowly at just one stream of people, then we're basically buggered.
Do apologise if anyone's offended by that. We're not quite at 9 o'clock yet. Tom, Anne-Marie?
So I think the challenge with reform, and Nigel Farage in particular, he's been very clear repeatedly that he wants to destroy the Conservative Party. So anyone who, you know, would wish to stand and be part of the Conservative family, we would welcome. And if that was what he wanted to do, but that is very clearly not what he wants to do. And he's, you know, clearly free to share his views and, you know, crack on with his own party. Our challenge as the Conservative Party, as Tom says, is to lick our wounds and look forwards and rebuild the trust with voters, all voters, about what we stand for, that we're serious, that we've rested and come back with a policy framework that's looking forwards for the next 10 and 15 years. And, you know, we'll take a little bit of time to get that right. And whichever of the four candidates wins, I hope that everyone will roll in behind them and support them, because it's really important that we do. You know, people voted reform. So in my constituency, people... Almost nobody told me on the doorstep that they were voting reform. It was really interesting. So if you talk to someone like Priti Patel, she said in Essex it was, you know, unbelievable. There was, you know, everyone was shouting reform. Yeah, I'm voting reform, not for you. In my patch up in Northumberland, nobody was telling me that.
So polite up there.
I know, charming. But, you know, and they were, I mean, I don't want to say they were embarrassed. I don't want to speak for them. But they didn't feel it was something that they were comfortable telling me about, as in they had voted for me before. And it sort of wasn't personal, but they needed to make their political point, which, of course, is the beauty of a democracy. That's what you can do here. And there is no, you know, bad outcome for the voter, as it should be. Democracy is so important. But by doing that and splitting the vote, now I get every time I go and do the shopping, I can't believe it. I'm so sorry my husband voted reform. We feel really bad now because we wanted to keep you as our MP. And I'm like, okay, well, that's what happens when you choose to vote somewhere else. So what we've got to do is rebuild that trust so that they don't have to make that choice.
Dare I ask how much you lost by?
So I lost by 5,000. There were 7,500 Reform votes.
I mean, you obviously thought a lot about that because, I mean, you would have won had Reform not stood.
Yes, if they hadn't stood, I would have won. I mean, a lot also, of my voters stayed at home as well. Nothing, they couldn't bring themselves to do anything else.
There's nothing you could have done about it.
No, it was a national scream. I call it the silent scream in my patch. It was loud elsewhere, but it was a silent scream in my patch.
Election.
Yeah. But you know what? That's okay. Now we've heard and we can now rest, recuperate and look forward.
Right, we've got another question on the Tory leadership, which we'll come to in a moment, and then something completely different, and we'll also have our fun question. Anne-Marie, I don't know, have you been on the programme before? I think you were on when I was off once.
Yeah, you weren't here.
Well, you'll be familiar with the fun question at the end. I hope you have a corker tonight. Right, it is 8:45 here on LBC.
This is LBC.
Dad, no one uses voicemail. Send voice notes. Oh, did you set up your dating profile? It's time to put yourself out there. Never too old to fall in love. So basically, me and Marty spoke to Zara from St. James's Place about saving for our honeymoon. After the house deposit, it looks like it won't be the Caribbean. More like Cornwall. Love you. Bye.
While you're looking out for the ones you love, our one-to-one financial advisors are looking out for you. St. James's Place. Invaluable advice.
With the biggest range of cars to buy entirely online, it's no wonder everyone's cinching it.
I cinched it during spin class. I think I'm going to be sick.
I cinched it in this coffee shop.
What are you having?
A five-door hatchback.
This is your captain speaking. I cinched it before takeoff with a 14-day money-back guarantee.
With so many great reasons to buy, the nation aren't just nailing it, they're cinching it. Comparison against equivalent retailers. Visit cinch.co.uk/range claim. Mileage restrictions and terms apply.
Join Andre Rieu live on the 9th of May at OVO Arena, Wembley, London. It's a magical evening full of humour, romance and enchanting melodies. Get your tickets now at andrerieu.com.
You don't need an office. You need an office. You don't need a shop. You need a shop. You don't need contractors. You need contractors. What your business doesn't need one month, it might need the next. That's why with O2 Business, you get automatic data rollover, so your business can flex as you need it to, giving you more business can do. Search O2 Business.
New or upgrading customers only on selected tariffs. 1 month rollover. Terms apply.
As a nation, we're a generous lot. You could say giving is in our blood. And right now, we need all of you Giving Taps to give blood and help provide life-saving treatments. Blood is amazing. It can help combat cancer, ease emergencies, help fight sickle cell, and create life-saving medicines. So, please book an appointment and give blood now. We have lots of appointments available at convenient times, and our donor centres are based in the heart of cities. It takes an hour to save up to 3 lives. If you're the Giving Type, please book an appointment at blood.co.uk today.
Need to print?
Take a hint. You can get toner and ink.
For less than you'd think.
From cartridgepeople.com.
From beatable prices.
Cartridge People.
Printing.
Sorted.
See online for our price promise.
Cross Question with Ian Dale on LBC.
Anne-Marie Trevelyan, Tom Skinner and Scarlett Maguire with us answering your calls. Michael is in Raynes Park. Hello, Michael.
Good evening there, Ian. Good evening, panel. My question is whether the Conservative Party membership should have a choice between all of the 4 leadership candidates who are attending conference without the leadership candidates being further whittled down to 2 by the Conservative Parliamentary Party. As a Conservative Party member, I'm quite frustrated at not being given a choice twice in the past decade.
Tom, I'd actually go completely the other way and would get the members to narrow it down to 2 and let the members of Parliament pick the final one. Because, if anything, over the last few years, what we have proved is that the loyalty and the unity of the parliamentary party really dictates a lot of what goes on. So I think I would flip it around and let the members have a choice of 2 and then let the MPs decide from there.
Anne-Marie.
So So I think I'm with Tom, actually. But the reality is that we can set the rules every time we do this. And I'm really hoping we don't do it for many, many years to come once we've picked this next leader. But the way the 9220 committee sets the rules can, you know, vary. And we are a party that can look at this again. So I think there's a really, exactly to Tom's point, there is perhaps an opportunity once we've chosen this leader to move forwards. I think the four great candidates are all showcasing really well at conference over this few days, and then the MPs will whittle them down to two, and it will be the membership who has the final call. Now, I think, you know, I hear Tom's point, and I think that, you know, there is a value in that. I think to not allow the members to have that would be worse, but I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer. If we can really rebuild that trust with the membership, which we've lost because it was a really rough election, you know, people went out and did what they do, incredible volunteering fashion, and were, you know, not rewarded with a great campaign, not rewarded with solid messages or the support that they needed. So we need to get that right.
Scarlett?
I do think, though, you need to make sure that you are offering members enough buy-in. You know, membership in mainstream political parties is declining. We've already talked about lack of trust and enthusiasm in mainstream politics. And I think that declining membership is both a symptom and then also a cause. And I think it's important for everyone that there's a little bit more buy-in on a grassroots level. And I do worry that if you were to further shut out the membership, that could suffer.
Right, let's move. Thank you, Michael. Let's move on to another Michael in Heathrow. Hello, Michael.
Hello. I'd like to ask, for from today, our ability to manufacture would depend upon the willingness of foreign governments and foreign companies to supply us with steel. I'd like to know why. Why don't any of the political parties understand that the ability to manufacture is fundamental, surely, to statehood?
That's a really interesting point. And of course, I think so. The Port Talbot plant is actually closed today, so we don't have any conventional steel manufacturing capability. But we sometimes forget that we are still the ninth biggest manufacturing nation in the world. I think everyone seems to think we manufacture nothing nowadays. It's simply not the case. But I think Michael makes a valid point. Anne-Marie, what do you think?
So I agree completely. Steel must be one of our sovereign capabilities. The closure of that last blast furnace. Not for another reason other than that she'd run her course. She needed replacing, therefore Tata weren't going to do that because clearly we're moving to clean steel production. So there is an electric arc furnace, the clean energy version coming through, which will have a reduction in job requirement, but it will start to produce clean steel, which is important in due course. But I think it's absolutely right. We need to make sure that we have that continuity and reliability of domestically produced steel, not only for the day-to-day, you know, our cars, you know, tin cans, through to, you know, weapons, ships, warships, tanks, you name it, all of it, that we can do that, because in times of trouble, when we talk about sovereign capabilities, that's why we talk about them, so that when there is a real crisis where supply chains may be damaged or broken for malign intent or not. You know, through COVID, we saw very damaged supply chains, not because there was a malign actor picking a war somewhere, but because countries closed down. We've got to be able to get ahead of that. So I hope very much that Labour will do what I did. So I did a lot of work when I was Trade Secretary around steel tariffs, making sure that we release some of the pressures on our steel companies to ensure that they could continue to be economically
viable. But your
viable.
Government could have done more. It could have ensured that there was a steel manufacturing capability in this country in the long term, even if it meant sort of quite hefty subsidies.
So I don't have the victim, but we supported the steel companies in many ways with financial and other support, as I say, through tariff resolutions, making sure that those particular areas of steel, we try to continue to make sure that they were able to access those. But this is a big issue that's been going on for years. You know, the reality is that China has been, over the last 10 and 15 years, dumping steel because they make vast quantities which they weren't necessarily needing to put to use, and disrupting the balanced and honest trade pricing in steel. And we saw the US take that on in fairly strong measures as well, I suppose.
Okay. Tom,
the steel industry is something that is symptomatic of our manufacturing capability over a long time. It's hugely expensive to manufacture steel. So Anne-Marie's right, we need to have some capability, but we're not going to get back to a situation where we're manufacturing millions and millions and millions of tons of it. And one of the things we worked on a lot when I was a special advisor in the Department of Science and Technology was trying to change our manufacturing base in the UK and really focus on advanced manufacturing, new composites, new drugs, and the real cutting-edge manufacturing.
Still need steel.
But we need to really lead the world in manufacturing, but stuff that other countries can't produce much more cheaply than us. And the real cutting-edge stuff is where we're going to do it. But Anne-Marie is right, we still need steel.
Scarlett?
I think you can see a lot of countries sort of realising that their populations are crying out for more homegrown industries, and that's part of the reason why I think a lot of places feel quite so left behind. I think it's something that we probably don't talk about often enough, and it doesn't get enough coverage. Interesting to see what direction Labour do go on with this. I think it's one of the most interesting questions to them, actually, about their industrial strategy. Obviously, we've heard stuff about their plans to open GB Energy in Aberdeen, but there's quite a lot of other stuff still waiting to hear, and I think it's interesting because I think it's definitely an opportunity.
Right, you answered very concisely, so we can fit in one more question before our final fun question, which I know you're looking forward to. This is a text question from Chrissy in Crawley. A 96-year-old woman has been given a suspended jail sentence for killing another pensioner when her car mounted a curb and hit her and another friend. Should there be a maximum age for driving? Now, the background to this is June Mills hit and killed 76-year-old Brenda Joyce on Merseyside in August of last year, while 80-year-old Jennifer Enser also suffered injuries. Mills pleaded guilty to causing death by dangerous driving and was given that 18-month suspended sentence and banned from driving for 5 years. As the youngest member of our panel, Scarlett, I'm coming to you. I think you're younger than Tom. What's your answer?
I can't drive myself, so I feel quite bad passing judgment on other people being able to or not. But I do think, as you just hearing the words 96-year-old driving doesn't fill you with much confidence. And actually, I was going to say something about my dad, but he might be listening, so I'm not going to say it.
And your dad's probably younger than me.
I don't think so. Sorry, Dad.
But, I mean, a suspended jail sentence, if this 96-year-old had been 56, I'm not so sure that would have been suspended.
No, you don't think so. But, I mean, at 96, is there much point to jail, I mean, not to anything else?
No, there isn't.
No.
Anne-Marie.
So, what a tragic story.
It is.
There are lots of points after a certain age when, in order to maintain your driving licence, HMRC demands various medical tests and requirements.
You mean
DVLA. I'm so sorry. Yeah, you're right, I did. Well, the tax man's always after you as well. I mean, that never changes however old you are. So it feels like there may have been a gap in there somewhere, or indeed that, you know, they continued to drive because their eyesight was good, but their, you know, reactions were by definition slower. You know, sometimes terrible accidents happen because one has a health moment, ill health moment when driving, all those things, which is very hard. I think the suspended sentence is obviously the right outcome, but what a tragic story, and one that, you know, I think of, you know, members of my family, my granny now long gone, we, you know, had to force her to give up her car. She lived on her own. How else did she do her shopping? You know, Tesco's didn't deliver in those days. Other supermarkets were available, obviously. But, you know, so that was a real issue for her, and we had to kind of, you know, effectively negotiate a deal that she move and live close enough to us that I could take her to the supermarket every week. So she gave up her car because she was frightening us every time anyone got in it. But that's a really hard thing to ask someone who is, you know, kind of probably living on their own and still being independent.
Tom?
Yeah, so similar situation. My grandmother's given up driving now, which is definitely for everyone's better interests. But what happened as a family, although it's mainly my mum that did this, is sort of negotiate with her over time and slowly wean her off driving and sort of put in other support. And I think there's a big role for families in this, to manage the sort of decline of their loved one in a sort of compassionate way that's right for them. Because I'm sure there's some 90-year-olds who are far better drivers than I am. But just because you're old doesn't mean you're a bad driver. I know some people in their 50s and 60s and 40s, terrible drivers. But there's a friends and family thing here, and I think some compassion from the family to say, look, this is not sustainable.
Right, let's go to our fun question. It's not that fun, actually. Sandra in Rotherham says, the late Queen and Sir David Attenborough have been voted our greatest cultural icons, with Princess Diana in third place. Who else should be on the list?
Can I go first so no one else can pinch mine? I adored the late Queen. I was gutted and sort of furious when she died, though I guess everyone's allowed to go to heaven. But absolutely top, she would have been top of my list, the most amazing lady. And David Attenborough is just fabulous. I've adored him and his programmes and his enthusiasm for wildlife. But if I was going to add my third one to that, it would be the now sadly just lost Dame Maggie Smith.
Oh, really?
Fabulous woman. I mean, didn't she just make you laugh, make you cry? Best actress.
I should say that Sir Winston Churchill came in fourth place, and Freddie Mercury, number five, I'm slightly surprised by.
Best music. Don't you sing out loud in your car when he's playing?
Meatloaf.
Oh,
me too.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. Learned
something new. Bat Out of Hell live album.
Paradise by the Dashboard Lights.
15 minutes of absolute joy.
I'm an ABBA girl every day.
Yeah, well, me too, but anyway. Scarlett.
I think I have a bit of a panic answer, but I was trying to think. But I don't actually watch really TV or films, but I do. I'm obsessed with the darts and have been for years, and I love it. And I think it's actually a great cultural institution that we have here.
So did you say darts?
I did say darts. I told you I panicked a bit. It's a bit idiosyncratic, but the darts commentator, Wayne Wardell, there's Sid Waddle before him, who's sadly dead because he was absolutely incredible. But Wayne Wardell, I just, every time I listen to him, I feel sort of comforted and at home and sort of deeply British.
Love that.
I'm profoundly shocked by that.
Tom, I thought you were going to go for Phil the Power Taylor, but that would have been a very, very good answer.
No, but he's a grumpy sort. You don't want to go for Phil the Power Taylor. There are so many nicer ones, even though he is iconic.
I was born and brought up in Portsmouth, so I used to enjoy nothing more than going round HMS Victory, so I would choose Nelson.
Oh, don't you love that as a patriotic ending to your programme?
As a patriotic Norfolk person. Yes, excellent.
We can go back to the conference singing the national anthem now.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Or Royal Britannia.
You see, we could sing British. Jerusalem now, if we had a mind to. Now, on tomorrow's panel, we have the former Tory Middle East Minister, Alastair Burt, the journalist and author, Rachel Shabby, the political strategist, Joe Tanner, plus a representative from the Lib Dems, as yet unnamed. So, don't know what to make of that. Anyway, coming up, thank you very much indeed, all three of you, for being on Cross Question today. Coming up in the next hour, Tom Lockyer, he is the captain of Luton Town Football Club. In December last year, he suffered a heart attack while playing for Luton Town at home. He was effectively clinically dead for 2.5 minutes, but was resuscitated through CPR and has made a recovery. And he's part of a British Heart Foundation campaign to increase the number of defibrillators across the country and to train people how to do CPR. Now, I don't know about you, but I've seen it happen on television, but I wouldn't really be confident being able to do it myself. It takes less than 10 minutes online.